Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, a global movement that seeks to center the child in all conversations about marriage and family. And as you know, if you've been tuning in over the last couple weeks, we go way beyond marriage and family as well, because there's really very few areas of culture, law, technology, politics, where we're putting kids first, and that's a problem. It's a problem because children are victimized when we, the adults, force them to sacrifice for us. So not so with us. In this hour, you're going to hear a child-centric framing of trending news, questions from our listeners, and even a little bit of Bible time. And we're going to kick things off with Bible time. If you've been following along over the last couple of weeks, you know I'm going through the book of Exodus, and there's endless treasure to be found in both the Old and New Testament, but there is something about, maybe it's because I live in Seattle, maybe it's because I feel like I am part of the remnant, the very few Christians that have not migrated to a red state. But I really do feel like the Old Testament, the prophets, have so much to say to us today. So this stood out to me when I was reading through Exodus. The Lord said to Moses, "See, I have made you as a god to Pharaoh, and Aaron, your brother, shall be your prophet. You shall speak all that I command you." And then he goes on to direct Moses to say specific things and to do specific things that are going to confront Pharaoh, confront the most powerful man, not just in the nation, but maybe in the known world at the time. This is incredibly high risk. It's incredibly high cost. And yet, Moses does it anyway. Thankfully, God sent him somebody to do it together, because it's hard to speak truth against a culture, especially if you're speaking alone. But even if you have somebody standing next to you, it's still very challenging. And yet, I am going to posit in this show that actually that is the duty of the church, that this is and should always be a hallmark of the church's role in culture. So I just want to read you this quote from Martin Luther King Jr. It says, "The church must be reminded that it's not the master or the servant of the state, but rather the conscience of the state. It must be the guide and the critic of the state, never its tool. If the church does not recapture its prophetic zeal, it will become an irrelevant social club without moral or spiritual authority." So that authority, right, that prophetic voice, it does not mean we unnecessarily critique. It does not mean that we are obstinate. It does not mean that we refuse to submit when it is in alignment with what God wants. But if we think that we are going to have any kind of role as salt and light, we are going to confront the greatest lies and the greatest powers of culture, as Moses and Aaron did. So I'm joined, as always, by my executive director, Josh Wood, who is well-read, loves the Lord. Josh, what do you think about this idea that if Christians are exercising their prophetic role, that they're going to confront cultural powers, maybe even tangible political powers?
Well, the story of Moses definitely gives me a lot of encouragement. I think sometimes the best people to do these things are the ones that God has to bring kicking and screaming. You know, it shows a level of humility for Moses. He spent some time in the wilderness. I think really thinking about the fact that he wanted the uprising, the freedom for his people earlier than God wanted. There was a timing to all of this, and there was more work to do in Moses' own life. And he comes out of the wilderness really a changed person, but still someone in need of, you know, an Aaron. And I just think that obviously extremely intimidating going to Pharaoh, like we said, and it can be that way. You know, I've heard you say before that culture threatens us with social isolation, that we're going to become a pariah. And I know Moses was thinking all of these things about humiliation and going back to the home and the court where he grew up and being a different person, and they haven't seen him in 40 years and he's been banished. There's all that fear. But I think we put too much of the spotlight on ourselves and forget that Moses was just, a tool in the hand of God. And these are big, scary things. And I do think Christians have to confront culture. They have to confront. They have to be the conscience of a nation. We have to sit at the table and offer kingdom-centered solutions to the world's problems. But it's okay if you're scared to death while you're doing it. And I think Moses gives us that example.
I think that, too, there is a line. There's no need to be reckless. We don't want to needlessly provoke. But the reality is that if we are going to be shaping culture rather than shaped by culture, that does have a critiquing element to it. I mean, we see this in the New Testament as well, where John the Baptist, he didn't stay in his lane and just preach the gospel of repentance. He critiqued Herod and his immoral relationship with Herodias, and it cost him. It cost him his life. And like you said, there's probably not a high likelihood that at least in this country at this moment of time, where our critique of government powers or cultural forces are going to cost us our life, but it probably will cost you relationships at some point. And that is something that you need to count when you're counting the cost of speaking up, but it should not stop you from speaking up. You can go into this clear-eyed and understanding the very high risk of walking straight up to Pharaoh and saying, "You are not the God of this people. My God, the one I serve, he is their God, and you will do what he says." And there's risk to that. And yet, I promise you, you obey God, even if there is a cost, and you will see his glory in the world, and you will see his good working itself out in your life as well. So we do hope to do that at Them Before Us Radio. We do hope to be a measured, reasonable, and clear-eyed critic of how culture is victimizing children, always in tandem with the Word of God, which spells out so clearly our role as defenders of children. And so we're going to walk through a couple trending news items in this segment and carrying into the next segment, because there's a lot happening in the news right now that connects with child rights and well-being. And we are not at the point where we have the luxury of turning a blind eye to this. We, as Christians, as believers who are called to critique the culture when it is victimizing the vulnerable, it is our mandate. So Josh is going to walk us through a few headlines. We're going to discuss some of what happened just this week that is putting children in perilous situations.
Well, I think there's a great parallel with, again, the life of Moses, that you could say, why do we need to get into the news? Like this, are we just like seeking outrage? Are you just trying to get people fired up? But I'd push back on that and say, you know, Moses became aware of the injustice because he saw it with his own eyes. And I do think there's a tendency for us, right? You don't need to live on cable TV and you don't need to be fall prey to just an outrage machine. But at the same time, guys, these things that get painted, like we're going to read about from California, as dystopian, as far off, as science fiction, oftentimes the devil cracks the door. And well-intended Christians turn a blind eye to small things because they can't see how the devil may use these things to make them big things. And very quickly, what was once science fiction becomes reality. What was once the slippery slope, right, scare quotes, becomes a sheer cliff, and we're down it quicker than we realize. And so I do want to say, I think it is our responsibility as Christians who care about not just our lives, but our grandkids, the next generation, the children. It is our responsibility to get our head out of the sand. It is our responsibility, like Moses, to walk and go see. Because I do think we'll see injustice, and I think we got to ask and pray God to give us eyes for these things. So a good example of this would be IVF generally, and then I want to talk about what's happening in California. So this comes from the Times. It's a source from the UK, and they're writing a story about the California VIP IVF industry. This article gives a look at the truly dystopian developments that are happening in the IVF space. It refers to California as the fertility capital of the world and highlights how the lack of regulation in California has led to a booming industry where kids can be customized by people with money, the parents, the customer. One family that wanted blue-eyed girls was highlighted. They can predict now eye color with a 92% accuracy. The doctor said, "We're not making blue eyes. explaining that he's instead selecting embryos with blue eyes. Now, Katie, I feel like he said the quiet part out loud. Do you want to dive into that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I went through this article. I tweeted several portions of it. And there was a guy who chimed on to that thread and said, well, I've got really terrible eyesight. If I could make sure that my children did not have my terrible eyesight, I'm not sure that I wouldn't take you up on that. And I said, let's be very clear here. They are not curing children with bad eyesight. They are eliminating children with bad eyesight. This is a project that creates designer children by fusing together egg and sperm in a petri dish in a laboratory, many, many more than the couple ever intends to implant or parent, so that they can select out the children that do not meet their specifications. And so it's very important for us to understand what's really happening here. We are making designer babies. Those designer babies are being sometimes born, but the ones that are built upon a pile of dead babies, the babies that were not worthy, that were eliminated, that didn't make the grade, that had the wrong eye color, that were the wrong sex. And very interesting, you know, I think a lot of us think, well, IVF is just about helping infertile couples have children. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's the case. But at this clinic, 90% of the customers don't have fertility problems. They're going to that clinic because when you make babies the old-fashioned way, you don't get to customize whether you get a boy or a girl. You don't get to customize the eye color of your child. You simply have to take whatever it is that the Lord hands you. And for a lot of these wealthy parents, they think they can do better than God. And as a result, they are eliminating what they would consider to be suboptimal children. I hope you are horrified by what we're describing right now. We are describing a process of customizing human beings and discarding and destroying the ones that don't meet our specifications.
It sounds like simulations where you know, I think the common misconception, because I do want to believe it's a misconception. I want to believe that if people were aware and this issue was presented properly, that people would make a different decision. And so I think the misconception, that's the generous term I'm going to use, is that it is some sort of a selection, like a generation, they're creating it, versus what it is in reality, with, where we're going to simulate 10, 12 pregnancies all at once. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to find the one, which begs the question, what's happening to the other 11? And they get donated, they get discarded, they get frozen.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And let's just be clear, they get donated to research so that those children, those tiny embryonic children, can develop for maybe 21 days, maybe longer, because nobody's monitoring, and we can experiment on them. Or they're being frozen. They are one of the 1.5 million embryonic children on ice in our country, many of which have been functionally abandoned. The parents are no longer in contact, paying the storage fees. What do you do? It is very likely, if you believe that life begins at conception, one of the greatest humanitarian crises that we have in this country right now. Or they are donated to another couple as if they are a sofa that you're tired of, but you don't want to pay the disposal fee or continue maintaining it in your house. You donate it to somebody else. And we might think, well, that sounds great, except that these donation processes conduct this exchange as if the children are property. It's not like an adoption process where the intended parents have to go through screening and vetting and backgrounds and home studies. No. These children are treated as items to be swapped and traded. So you start making children in a laboratory. And while there are some people who want to do this by respecting children's right to life, they don't want to sever a child from their mother or father through these processes, that is not the way that IVF in general, or what we call big fertility, operates on the regular. No. These are items for adults to get what they want if they pay enough money. And that is something that we, as protectors of children, need to be aware of. We're going to take a break, but we're going to come back. We're going to talk about some other trending news that intersects with child rights and well-being. First up is going to be this vote to protect IVF access nationally. And we're going to talk about the very high cost that that is going to level on children. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
I just want to say, as your host, Katie Faust, that I'm honored that you would give your attention, your time to tune into this broadcast, because what we're trying to do here is different from what you typically get from a weekend radio show, which might be some feel-good inspirational, which is all great. But we actually are on a crusade here to defend children, and we want you to be on board with us, because the truth is that children need champions, and we need to understand how children are being victimized, oftentimes in ways that we've never before grappled with as a species. And it's time for us to open our eyes and see some of the time-tested threats to kids in terms of sexualization or abuse or abandonment, but also the new threats to children that kids are facing because our technology has outpaced our ethics and our laws are moving beyond the realities of their own natural bodies, natural world, natural relationships, and natural rights. And so that's something that we want to make sure that as many people as possible understand and are aware of. Why? Because we need to fight for kids. So in the last segment, we spent some time talking about a very high-end fertility clinic in California that is creating customized children for wealthy couples who largely don't experience infertility. They just want to pick and choose the characteristics of the children that they're going to welcome into the world. And unfortunately, a lot of little lives are going to die as a result. Now we're going to talk about some national news, because IVF has very interestingly become a trending news item in this election cycle, both on the left and the right. So Josh, tell us what's happening this week on the IVF front nationally.
So they're going to set up a vote to basically to make politicians cast a vote for or against this idea of IVF. I think it would probably be helpful for our listeners to start kind of at square one here. The pro-life movement, which so many of you are a part of, have been a part of, volunteering, going to pregnancy centers, has been against people ending their pregnancy. It's been pushing for people to recognize the life in the womb. Now, this and the messaging around it, this IVF bill, has caught some people off guard, because Katie, I think for a lot of our listeners, it's like, wait a second. We're for pregnancy. We're for life. And this sounds like a lot of people, IVF broadly, sounds like a lot of people who are trying to create more life. Can you explain, just to start the conversation, how the pro-life movement and its protection of unborn life and the IVF movement, and specifically our opposition to the IVF bill, how that that's the same team. These are similar values. Explain that.
Yeah. This is something where we need a lot of clarity, and then we need a lot of courage once we have that clarity. So what is the clarity that we need? Children are human. They have a right to life from the moment of conception. As we know, in the abortion battle, children cannot defend this right on their own. That is the job of adults. It is our job to defend children's right to life.
And conception, Katie, just again, because that's a goalpost that's been tried to be moved by doctors, is what?
Yeah. Conception is the moment that egg and sperm meet. Typically, that has never been possible outside of the womb.
Nor debated.
But as we see, people that are working to violate children's right to life are now sliding that definition, both in the baby taking industry of abortion and the baby making industry of big fertility. They'll say, well, it's not really a baby until implantation, or we don't actually know when it becomes a baby. And so what this allows for is, number one, permissiveness around things like Plan B, right? The pill that you take after sex to terminate a pregnancy before the baby has a chance to implant or prevent the baby from implanting. And so they say, well, it's not really a pregnancy. It's not really a baby until implantation. No, that is not true. embryology is pretty conclusive that the moment that egg and sperm fuse, it creates a whole new genetic code, a brand new child that has never before been seen and never will be seen again. The blueprint of fingerprints that have never before touched an ink pad are about to develop. This is the moment life begins. Now, the baby making industry of IVF is also working around that category and saying, well, it's not really a pregnancy until implantation. Well, how convenient that you are forcing children to be conceived in a situation, in an environment where they cannot implant without your permission and your assistance, right? So you're co-opting this language of when life begins, when pregnancy begins, so that you can manipulate children out of existence and into existence. And the result is, of course, in both of these domains, children are dying. They are being killed in both the abortion world and the IVF world.
So our opposition then to a bill that seeks to make this broad bucket term, IVF, a right is, you know, we want to hit pause and say, we want to talk about a different set of rights, the right not to be frozen, the right. I mean, we want to go that way and say, hold on. IVF means, one person says IVF, they mean one thing, another person, another thing. We even saw that with Tim Walz. He said, well, I had IVF. Well, actually, I didn't. I had a different kind of procedure. I wasn't sure of the language. So again, Katie, I think it would be good to say there's one group pushing for IVF to become a right. A, what do they mean when they say that? But then B, what are we here at Them Before Us, who are, we are child protectors. We are calling adults to sacrifice on behalf of kids. What are we saying are the rights in this situation that need to be protected?
Unfortunately, right now, neither candidate on either side of the political ticket is getting this right. President Trump in the presidential debate did say, hey, I'm a big champion of IVF. He proposed mandating that insurance companies cover IVF. But let's be very clear what that means. You are mandating a drastic increase in the number of children who will be discarded through IVF. You are going to be, and you're going to see an explosion of the 1.5 million children who are currently on ICE. You are going to be subsidizing the creation of motherless and fatherless children, because it's not just the sweet heterosexual couple next door that's employing the IVF services. It is single, same-sex couples, throuples, that are seeking to use these technologies. And even though we don't have the exact numbers anywhere, our guess is 1/3 to 2/3 of the 90,000 children born through IVF annually are going to be cut off from their mother or father as a result. So you're creating orphans. You're not just creating a pile of dead baby bodies. You are manufacturing orphans. And so whenever you have a proposal such as the one that's been brought up in the Senate on Tuesday to protect IVF as a right, really what you're doing is you are paving the way for somebody to say, you can't stop me from creating 20 embryos and discarding 18 of them. You can't stop me from using somebody else's sperm or somebody else's egg or somebody else's womb to create a fatherless child. I have a right to a child, regardless of how many babies' bodies are destroyed and how many relationships with their mother or father are destroyed. This is my right. And so that is a lot of the way that we frame the conversation around IVF as adult rights, adults' right to a child, adults' right to parenthood. And the Democrats will frame this as a matter of sexual rights, reproductive rights. That's not how it is. That is not how we look at it. And that's not how you should look at it. Primarily, this is a matter of child rights. Children have a right to life. Children have a right to be known and loved by their mother and father whenever possible. IVF and big fertility overwhelmingly violates children's rights on both of those fronts.
So in essence, we have two competing ideologies around rights. And in one situation, the adult's rights to create a baby in whatever way they want, in whatever manner, by whatever arrangement, our argument would be that requires necessarily the violation of children's rights. So we aren't against, we don't want to paint ourselves as against adults. Our contention is there are children's rights to be considered. They're not being considered. And what you're proposing would require all of those rights, which would include their right to life, which is the tie back to the pro-life movement. And why we think if you're pro-life, this is part of your camp now, is that that would require their right to life to be violated.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I will say, there is no right to a child. You don't have a right to a child. You don't have a right to parenthood. If you have a right to the child that you have conceived, that is true. But if your right to IVF means a child loses their right to life or their right to their mother and father, that is not a real right. That's not a natural right. Just because you call something a right doesn't make it a right. And very often when we misidentify rights, such as the right to choose, it is kids who pay the price. And so we have to be very careful about how we think and speak and vote on these kinds of issues, because very real children, their lives and their fundamental relationships are at stake.
Well, Katie, it occurs to me that you mentioned once we have clarity, we need to have courage. Boy, it's really hard, though, to talk about this issue, feel convicted, understand that it's a part of the pro-life movement, that this is a matter of protecting kids and their right to life, in addition to not being frozen, in addition to not being selected out of existence because they don't have blue eyes, or they've only got an 8% chance of having blue eyes. But what do we do when so many of our friends, so many of our relatives, maybe even ourselves, were products of this process?
Mm-hmm. Well, as always, the child protective lens and framework is the answer. Because we're not against children created through IVF. We don't think that they are less worth. We don't think that they have less dignity. We actually are so serious about children's worth and dignity that we think all children created through IVF, not just the 93% to 97%, the 3% to 7% that are born alive, but all of the other children that were discarded, donated to research, deselected, and stuck in a freezer forever, we actually believe that they also have dignity, that they also deserve protection. We don't critique IVF because of the children born through it. We critique IVF because of all the children who were never given the chance to be born through it. So unfortunately, this is an area where I understand there is and can be a social cost to speaking up about it. But don't allow somebody to say, you're against me for wanting to pursue this, or you're against a child that was created through IVF. That is not true. And don't allow that to shackle you or hamstring you from speaking. You and I speak up against these kinds of child commodifying practices exactly because we love children, not because we're against them.
And now, we talked at the beginning a little bit about the dystopian nature of some of this, how sci-fi becomes a reality so often. And I'd love to get your thoughts on, if this becomes a right, it significantly curtails our ability to then put any type of regulation on it without it becoming some sort of a rights issue. We're violating their fundamental right, depending on where they find this right, if it gets challenged. And I'd love to hear this technology, when we divorce this process away from a mother and a father in the context of marriage, using their own biology to create a child, when we divorce and separate these pieces out to include third parties, what is possible now? It occurs to me that our character might not have caught up to our technology at this point, to where we are now enabled to do some crazy things that necessitates that right now, before we get there, we think well about these topics and develop an apologetic to defend why we must take a hard stand on this topic.
Mm-hmm. Well, honestly, like, we are opening the dystopic Pandora's box. When you separate, so Christian ethicists have historically bound together three different components: sex, marriage, and babies. When you separate sex from marriage, as you do through the hookup culture, right, or the sexual revolution, when you separate sex from babies, which we did with things like the birth control pill, when you separate babies from sex, which we are doing through IVF, and when we separate babies from marriage, which happens very frequently in the cultural narratives that say that, you know, kids don't need a mother and a father, right? Marriage is just a piece of paper. Notice that children are always the ones that suffer. Anytime you break that triad of sex, marriage, and babies, which in the biblical sexual ethic, all three of those are going to go together. you are now incredibly at risk of peril. Obviously, I think this harms adults as well, but it drastically harms children. And that is what we're seeing on the IVF front. So we know in our mind, we think, well, this is just about helping infertile couples have children. Anytime you are breaking that sex marriage baby's bond, kids are going to pay the price. They have to be at the forefront of our mind when we are making decisions about this kind of thing. And when you separate sex from babies, you are going to get situations of elderly men who are acquiring children through IVF and then surrogacy and taking those children home, you know, and they're in their 50s or 60s and they're a couple. And now that baby is going to grow up separated from half their biological identity, dealing with the mother hunger, the separation of losing their birth mother, and probably going to be like, they were probably commissioned just to be the caretaker of two elderly men. We also have, people, especially in the state of California, who are visiting California to create custom ordered children. Like, this is happening heavily through Chinese intended parents. A high percentage of them are single men, and a high percentage of them are single men older than 40 years old, who are creating a child through California IVF clinics and surrogates and taking the baby back to China. A lot of the times, they don't even come and touch US soil, but their child is a US citizen. And now they have a foothold to gain citizenship later in their life. We have had for a long time single women and same-sex women who are using IVF to create fatherless children. And we have stories now of children who are 20, 30, and 40 years old who are the products of single mothers by choice or same-sex female couples talking about how this impacted them, their need for father connection. So we've already been this down this road. It's not getting any better. We need to clearly think about reproductive technologies, including IVF, and take the perspective of this is not about me. This is about child protection.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. I know that that was a heavy dose of conversation around reproductive technologies and IVF. Obviously, we think that this is something that you should not just know about, but actually really have a deep understanding of, because real lives are at stake here, the lives of children. And we are, you know, if we do anything right in this broadcast, it is for you to come away from this hour having an understanding and a heart for child protection and understanding what it is that you can do to advance the rights and well-being of kids. Now, that is a little bit easier said than done when we're sort of talking about things from an idealistic perspective. But there is a lot of complication and complexity when the rubber meets the road, when you have all of these lofty principles, whether they're ethical or biblical, and then you have to apply them to challenging real life situations. So that's what we try to tackle in the last segment of Them Before Us Radio. We want to hear from you. We want to answer some of your questions because we understand that we can talk about this in the abstract and it's neat and clean. But when it comes to kind of your real life world, sometimes it's messier. So as always, I've got Jen Friesen, Them Before Us Training Director, on the line with me to pitch some of the questions that you, the listeners, have asked this week. Welcome back, Jen.
Hey, Katie. Hey, everyone. That was a great conversation you guys had. And this first question really ties into that pretty well. You know, a lot of people would be rightly incensed that people are trying to edit for things like hair color or skin color or eye color. But Gordon asks, is it really that bad to use technology to edit other things out, like disabilities or diseases? Wouldn't there be a good side to these technologies too?
Well, at this point, we don't have the ability to customize children. Now, that's not to say they are not hoping to do that. There is a technology out there called CRISPR technology that actually works to edit the genes of children before they are born. This is something that is largely denounced by the global community of bioethicists. However, it was tried and attempted a couple of years ago by a Chinese scientist who supposedly edited the genes using this technology to supposedly make children a little more impervious and like less susceptible to AIDS, to carrying certain diseases. Now, the problem with that, and the children were born alive, as I understand it, the problem is that when you mess with a genetic code or a part of the genetic code, you don't necessarily know what else you're affecting. You think, okay, I'm going to edit this gene and it's going to have this impact, but genes can be multifaceted, multi-layered, and we are really just experimenting on tiny humans. We don't exactly know what is going to happen. So we don't at this point, even though we have the theoretical capability of editing a child's gene, it is not approved. It is largely something that is not permissible yet. On the international scene, especially in Western countries that still have some degree of ethics that are hemming in what scientists are able to do with these tiny lives. But that's not to say that there are not some kind of attempts to create the kind of children that you want. We talked about that a little bit in terms of the high-end fertility clinic in California, where 90% of the customers are not dealing with infertility. They just want a customized child, right? The right sex, even the right eye color. But this is not happening through curing children. This isn't happening through actually creating and eliminating certain diseases from that child's genetic code or future. You're doing this by eliminating children. So for example, we have had the ability for a couple of decades to recognize children with Down syndrome, for example, in the womb. There are genetic screening and genetic testing that we are able to do. We certainly have been able to do it once the child is conceived and implanted and is growing. Now we have pre-implantation screenings that allow us to screen out children with certain kinds of conditions, whether it is Down syndrome or trisomy 13 or something like that. But let's be very clear, we're not healing these kids. We're not trying to make their lives better. We're eliminating those lives. And famously, Iceland allowed for these kinds of screenings to take place in pregnant women. And as of this date, children with Down syndrome have not been born in that country for years. And it's not because they've cured Down syndrome. They've eliminated the children with Down syndrome. So that's exactly what we're talking about with these kinds of technologies. We're not curing, we're not restoring, we're eliminating the undesirables. That's what's happening in big fertility right now. Jen, you, before I forced you to be my very, very first full-time staff member at Them Before Us, you worked with a lot of young people who had developmental disabilities. So I'm sure you've got opinions on this as well.
Yeah, the Iceland study is something we talk about a lot, or we used to in the work I used to do, because yeah, exactly to your point, especially the technology as it is right now, you can't just clip tiny little pieces out of the DNA and have there be no other issues, you know? So they're actually just eliminating the embryos that have those undesirable things. I think the biggest thing that stands out to me is the idea of who determines what's desirable or not. And kind of to Gordon's question, you know, people who say, well, we don't want people to have cerebral palsy. So if they can eliminate people who have cerebral palsy, or let's say further down the road, you could actually clip that out of the DNA somehow. But the problem is, what happens when there's people in power who have that technology who actually want to clip things like people who don't have white skin or something like that, right? So that's kind of the danger with the technology, is that people say it could be used for positive things, or we're going to use it for this. But the reality is, it opens up a big can of worms, it seems. And it's kind of like there's no stopping it once we start going that direction.
I spoke with one woman who had a hereditary condition that had somewhat affected her life. You know, there were some challenges as a result of it, but she was, you know, working full time and very successful in her career, but it was somewhat inconvenient. And she went through the process of creating IVF embryos, not because she was infertile, but because she didn't want her children to have to deal with that hardship that she had to deal with. But what they were doing is they were creating embryos. They were evaluating whether or not the embryos had the condition that she grew up with. And then they were discarding the ones that did. And if you look at it from that perspective, you're discarding yourself. What you're saying is that I wasn't worthy of life. I should have been edited out. I should have also been filtered out of existence because of this condition that sure is inconvenient for me, but did it impact like her value, her dignity? No, it didn't. So this is actually a pretty important point for followers of Christ, for people that ascribe to a biblical worldview. Your ability, your location, your age doesn't determine your worth. There's all kinds of reasons why you might be marked out as having some kind of disability or disadvantage, but in our worldview, that does not mean that you are less than. It actually has been and must continue to be a hallmark of believers who say, I'm going to welcome this life, I'm going to care for this life, regardless of how able they might be. And honestly, this is kind of personal for me because our youngest child is adopted, was abandoned because of a disability that he experienced. And thank God they didn't have access to the kinds of technologies that a lot of these fertility clinics do, and obviously did not have some kind of screening ability when his mother was pregnant, because he very likely would have been eliminated. He's worthy of life. He's worthy of love. He has just as much dignity as my other children do. So we have got to approach this differently. And if reproductive technologies are going to elevate certain lives and diminish other lives, it's a mindset and a technique that has to be rejected.
Yeah, that's good. And if you get to know people who have all different kinds of special needs, whether it's physical or developmental, you see what they bring to the world that is so unique and beautiful and needed, necessary in the world. So I think, yeah, if you don't know people with special needs, that's a good reason to go out there and get to know some people.
And I think, one thing to that, you know, I don't see a lot of people with Down syndrome these days, except at church. And I think that that might be how it continues to go, that in the future, you might not see people with serious disabilities from birth, unless you go to church. And that should be a manifestation of how and why we think differently about children and about people. But I will say we have one of those developmentally disabled people who sits in the pew sort of across from me, and we both sit in the back these days. And if the preacher says amen, she goes amen 100% of the time. And everybody loves it. Everybody loves it. She brings so much joy. And I always think, why don't I have that kind of response? Why don't I have that kind of zeal? She is showing me up. And yeah, she's different, but it doesn't mean that she doesn't have something to offer that honestly nobody else in the congregation seems to be willing to bring.
Yeah, I love that. All right, our next question is from Harper. She asks, what should I tell a friend who's considering leaving her husband? They have two elementary age children.
This is very tough. And it's hard to know what to say if you don't know the circumstances that they're going through. If it's a situation where there is abuse, if the woman or the children are at risk, if there is something where their lives are at stake, their safety is at stake, then there's a very good possibility that a separation needs to be considered. But there's a really good chance that that's not what's going on, because the majority of couples that are seeking to separate and divorce these days are not from high conflict relationships. They're not from abusive situations. It's usually because one or both, but usually one, is dissatisfied. And not because they're going through something that is completely superficial. There's a lot of reasons why throughout the course of a marriage, whether it's 5 years, 10 years, 15, 50 years, you're going to be dissatisfied. There might be some genuine tensions. There might be some actual struggles, whether it is some kind of addiction issue, porn addiction, porn use, whether it is kind of struggling with communication, dealing with the childhood baggage that often doesn't manifest until you're parenting your own kids. I mean, these are really, really big issues. The solution, however, is not for the adults to split and require the children to move between homes every month, every week, or every couple days. It is simply a transference, right? What divorce is at that point is a transference of the struggle from the adult shoulders to the children's shoulders. And what is going on with the adults, especially if it's in that 70% of marriages that are low conflict, that do have some genuine struggles, but that can be worked out, is they are saying, we are not willing to do the hard thing to mend the marriage. Instead, we are going to force these two elementary school children to do hard things so that we don't have to. We spend a lot of time talking about that at Them Before Us, because There is an inversion of the parent-child relationship when the parents choose the easy exit. It is, in essence, insisting that children be understanding, supportive, and accommodating of what the adults want. And it should be the exact opposite. Jen, do you have something to add to that?
I think it's a great idea to ask a bunch of questions, like you're saying, figure out the circumstances, especially if the person's part of a faith community, really encourage biblical counsel, faithful counsel. And I think sharing some of the stories that we have on our website or some of the data and the stats that we have posted all over, even things like people who stick out difficult marriages, the marriages will get better over time. You know, people can stick it out and pursue counseling and help and it can get better. I think that people feel like, well, my choice is getting divorced or staying like this forever. And maybe there's a third way. But I think the stories of kids, how this will impact your kids, could really help people make a different decision.
Looking at it from the child's perspective can be very clarifying.
Yeah.
All right. We don't have a lot of time. Jen, hit us hard with this last question.
Shortest answer, elevator answer. Todd wants to know, are you against same-sex parents having kids or adopting?
Okay. Wow. Let's just end with a really easy one, shall we? The answer is that if you're going to have children, you are going to require a man and a woman to make that baby. And if you make the baby, you need to conform your life to the baby. The baby must not conform their life to you, to your romantic attractions. So if you're making babies the old-fashioned way, everybody, single, married, gay, straight, needs to conform to the rights of the child to be known and loved by their mother and father, and needs to see their own mother and their own father loving each other, because it helps them understand how to form and maintain their own healthy relationships. So you should not make a baby with the express intent to separate the baby from the parent and raise them with somebody of the same sex, or raise them with somebody else of the opposite sex, right? The baby needs their mother and father to conform to what they need and deserve. In terms of adoption, same-sex couples don't have a right to adopt. Heterosexual couples don't have a right to adopt. Children who have lost their parents have a right to be adopted. They are the client. It is their needs, it is their desires, it is their rights that need to be considered when we're looking at adoptive placements. That means we should always prioritize married men and women when it comes to adoption situations. Now, sometimes that may not be possible. The reality is that when you're talking about foster kids, sibling groups, children who have extreme special needs, unfortunately, there may not be enough heterosexual married couples to bring the child into their family. There might be times where a social worker will say, a single woman might be the best placement for this child. Maybe there's a time where a same-sex couple, especially if they are a relation, you know, an aunt or two uncles or something like that, maybe that's the best placement. But ultimately, when we're looking at what's best for the kids, children deserve a mother and father, and adoption needs to facilitate that whenever possible. That's all the time we have. We're so grateful that you gave your time and attention to putting them before us today.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.